You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
And now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to, that one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble and drunk. Trouble on the drum, beat out old trouble on the drum, and kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum, beat me that rhythm on the drum, beat me that rhythm on the drum, and kick old trouble out the door. Kick him out the door, kick him out the door, kick him out the door, kick him out the
Welcome to Radical Australia and Community Radio's 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. In case nature calls, or the bikie next door knocks on your door for a cup of sugar for the his Myth Lab, relax, the program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au/Radical Australia. And Henrietta, the producer, refuses to speak, will have done all the nice work and would have podcast the program. There's hundreds of podcasts there of boring people, interesting people, and fascinating people. So I encourage you to have a look at the, well, listen to the podcast. You can't look at them, you listen to them. Look, Henrietta, just put on your bloody microphone. Don't mumble in the background. Now, there's a chap here who thinks this is the most unprofessional thing he's ever seen. Mumbling in the background, refuses to speak in the microphone. Terence Riggs, R-I-G-G-S, commonly known as Terry.
Well, more often Riggsy.
Riggsy. Oh, my God, you're one of them, are you? A Riggsy.
That's what workers call their mates.
Riggs, what?
They don't call them their real name, they call them something else.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I remember I was talking to a cop once. I said, mate, and he said, you're no mate of mine. I said, it's the same. All right. When were you born, Terry?
When? 1955.
Where?
Altona, in the Altona Hospital, which no longer exists.
Yeah, it's been, what they say, it's been amalgamated to the Western General, I assume. That's what happens to the little hospitals these days. And I assume at your age, your parents aren't with us anymore?
They're not with us, no.
No. Well, have any brothers or sisters?
Four brothers and three sisters.
Roman Catholic, I assume?
Irish Catholics.
Irish Catholics. You can pick it, catch you in those days. So what did your dad do for a crust?
He was a career Air Force man. He was an officer in the RAAF.
All right. So you went everywhere?
Not a lot, really. No, lived in Altona. Yeah. He was on the RAF base at Laverton. Moved to East Sale.
Right. What, the whole family or just him?
Oh no, the whole family.
The whole family.
They give the officers a house.
Yeah,
on
they
the
do.
Base.
That's right.
It's quite a nice house.
Yeah, you get a nice house. Yeah. So, did you do any school in Altona? Did you go to school in Altona?
St Mary's Primary School.
And what was that like?
Quite liked it. Mm. The nuns were pretty reasonable.
Mm.
You could even have a laugh with them.
Well, it is a boring life being a nun. You know, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You speak to a lot of people your age on this program because young people are too smart to come on the program. and it's interesting how few have had bad experiences in Catholic schools. Obviously, some have had horrific experiences.
Well, I'm going to correct you there.
You told me you had a laugh with the nuns. Come on, correct me now. Come on.
You told me about Altona.
Yeah, we're only at Altona. You're happy at Altona?
I'm happy with Altona.
Yeah, and how long did you last there before you moved to Sale?
Perhaps grade three.
Grade three. And did you have your brothers and sisters were older than you and they protected you at the school?
I'm the eldest.
Oh, you're the eldest. You're the thug. You're the one who protected them. All right. So was your father involved in World War II?
In a roundabout way. He was training.
Training.
He was training to fly, and I think the training aircraft at the time was the Tiger Moth.
Yep.
And then the war ended, so he had to find another job in the RAF.
In the RAF. Right. So he enlisted during World War II, you think?
He did.
Right. And your mum, obviously, she'd have her hands full of seven of you little brats, wouldn't she?
She did have her hands full, yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of... Because you wouldn't have had family to assist you, would you?
No, because my mother came from North Queensland, my father came from the New South Wales-Queensland border. Uh-huh. So there was no family in Victoria.
No. Well, that's one of the sad things, really. Because when you move, you lose all those contacts. And if you have kids... It's a really hard slog. So did she make all your uniforms and all that stuff? Or?
You know what? My mum's a dear old soul.
Right.
But she's the youngest of a fairly big family.
Right.
And her father, he was a builder, but he also had at least one hotel, maybe more. So she was brought up in a hotel.
Right.
She's the youngest.
Right.
So somebody else does all that stuff. Somebody else cooks, cleans.
That's right.
She played violin and piano.
Right.
That's her forte.
Right. So where in North Queensland was she from?
Innisfail and Cairns.
Oh, right.
And she would have gone to school at a private girls' school up on the... like Cooktown or somewhere like that.
Yeah. And what was her surname?
Lees.
And what was your dad's first name?
First name?
Yeah, he's Christian.
Bill. He's Bill. Bill Riggs.
Bill Riggs.
Probably Scottish extraction.
Yeah.
And my mother's Irish extraction.
Right. How did they meet, do you know? It sounds interesting.
Well, who knows?
World War II, I assume.
It would have been on the RAF base, and I've got an idea, even though I don't know how my mother got a job as a driver because she's not a very good driver. She was a driver, and she must have given him a lift on the base or
something. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Obviously, the sort of one thing led to another.
Yeah, well, it was World War II. They did have a shortage of trained people. All right. So, how long did you stay in Sale for?
Well, I left when I was about 16.
Mm, so from grade three, which would have been what, six or seven, something like that, to the age of 16, you stayed in Sale.
Yes.
All right. Well, tell us about these lovely schools you went to in Sale that you suggested before weren't the best.
Well, the first one was another St Mary's.
All right.
St Mary's in Sale, and I've got no complaints about that. Right. I thought they were pretty good.
Right.
But then you had to go to the Maris Brothers.
Ah, yes. Discipline.
Oh, it was more just corporal punishment than discipline.
Yeah, it was just for the hate. They've got to keep you bastards in line. I mean, I went to a public school, so it didn't matter, you know, just an ordinary state school, but you had to go to these religious schools. They did have a reputation. What, you had the strap, the cane, and a slap to the face occasionally?
I got a punch in the head one day.
A punch in the head? What did you do?
Well, this is a combination of a lot of things I'm probably guilty of.
All right.
And I'm pretty sure that myself and another student...
Mm.
Went to the Brothers Tabernacle up in their secret room.
Well, and you stole their wine, you bastard.
Drank it.
You drank it.
drank the wine and ate the host.
Ooh.
I think that was a step too far.
Eating the host, yeah. The blood and body of Christ you ate. So there wouldn't have been any for the Sunday Mass. Been at Sale. You know, you had to get the host from Melbourne.
I don't know. I don't even know when they did that thing, you know. Like, not necessarily a Sunday mass. I think the brothers had their own little shindig up there.
Every day.
Anytime.
Yeah, they had to confess every day. So why did you leave at 16?
Well, that was halfway through year 11.
Mm.
And there's been a lot of corporal punishment over the years. But I just thought, you know what, the head brother punched me in the head while he was interviewing me, and I thought, you know what, I don't think he's allowed to do that. So that evening, I mentioned that to my father.
Right.
And he didn't say anything.
Right.
And but he's turned up at the school the next morning.
Yep.
And he's had a talk to this brother.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had to, I imagine they're negotiating some sort of settlement.
Right.
I think my father was, he's aggrieved for a start, but then he's probably thinking of my
future
education.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he negotiated with the brother that I would successfully pass year 11, but would have to just go.
In other words, he said, if you don't do this, I'll punch you in the head. And I'm bigger than you, he said to the brother.
He was much bigger. I reckon that brother would have been scared of my father. He's like, he's a rugby player.
Yeah. So what does a young lad at 16 do when you finish school? Well, removed from the schooling in Sale.
Well, you're old enough to remember this. They had a thing called the Reds game.
Oh, yeah, yep.
And they were desperate for fruit pickers in Sunraysia.
Right.
They put you on a train,
mm-hmm.
sent you up to Mildura, and got you a job. That's what I did for a couple of years.
Right. What was that like?
I liked it.
Well, didn't get a bad back?
No, I was a fit young man.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, I did some fruit picking down at what's called Lilydale now in the late 60s, early 70s. I lasted 3 hours picking cherries. I thought, this is not for me. I got back on the train and went back to Melbourne.
Grapes are not that hard because they're on trellis.
Yeah.
Like if you're picking like strawberries or tomatoes, that'd be a different matter.
Yeah. And what was the accommodation like?
Just like a bush shack straight out of like a Banjo Patterson book. That was all right. It had everything you needed, didn't it?
Did you make any mates, long-term mates from that?
Not long-term mates because I was the only picker on a particular block, so I was on my own.
Yep. Oh. So how long? That lasted a few years, did it? A
couple of years, yeah.
What did your dad and mum think about this? Here there is their elders picking fruit.
Probably not happy about it.
They didn't say anything to you.
No.
No. No, fair enough. Oh, what, they were frightened of you?
No.
All right. So what did that lead to? Here you are, picking fruit. Obviously you've got jack of it. You know, it's not the type of thing you want to do all your life.
I decided to just keep going. So, like, I picked fruit all the way from Shepparton to Mariba.
Mariba. Wow.
And other things, yeah. Tobacco and Mariba.
Yeah.
And in those days, you could just hitchhike.
That's
and
right.
And people would give you a lift.
They would. Cash jobs, I assume. Didn't worry about.
No, not necessarily cash jobs. I think some of them definitely took tax out.
Yeah.
But they didn't give you a lot of money, Joe.
No. You didn't get much. Would you describe yourself as a gun picker by the end of it?
I wouldn't say gun picker, no, because I did run into other people who just seemed to pick a lot more than me, but I wasn't bad. I think I could pick in Griffith on Granny Smith apples on a good day. I could pick 10 bins. And that was $4 a bin. So $40 a day wasn't too bad then.
That's brilliant. That is very good in those days. Yeah, I'm thinking about it. Yeah, that is excellent. So what did you do with all that money?
I didn't save it, that's for sure.
You didn't save it. He doesn't want to mention what he did with it. All right. So you just you'd hitchhike from job to job. It's quite easy. Just walk in, because you knew there was a labour shortage in the 70s.
Oh, if you couldn't get a job in those days, you weren't trying.
Now, that was the good old days when the Commonwealth Employment Office was a government office.
Every town, every little town had one of those. And
exactly.
And actually, that'd help you out.
That's right. You'd walk in, you look on the board, see if there's a job going. You'd either turn up or phone up and you'd start. I remember we used to have 3 months' holidays during medical school. And I lived in my parents and I, we lived in an industrial area. So at the beginning of the holidays, you'd just walk around and knock on doors. And I got to Lysart Steel and they said, oh, we've been looking for somebody, to rouseabout, young rouseabout. And I said, do you want me to start tomorrow? And the bloke said, no, you can start now. That's how short they were. Yeah, people can't imagine. Can't imagine what it was like. So when you're picking fruit, what type of people were picking fruit? Were they young people like you or people who's a lifetime been itinerant workers? And
mostly people like me, but there were there were like whole families that would usually have a caravan.
Yep.
Children, mum and dad, and they'd all work together.
Right.
Now, I saw a bit of that.
Yeah. So no schooling.
School of hard knocks.
Exactly, yeah. Had to survive. People talk about unemployment benefits today. That wasn't very much in those days.
No, when I first went on unemployment benefits as, under 18, I think it was, $4 a week.
Yeah. That's why everybody was working. But the good thing is for your unemployment benefits, there was none of this bullshit that you've got to go through these days. And I remember I had mates that would get in their panel van and, drive around Australia collecting their cheque at the post office,
You could have it forwarded to
a post office. That's right. And no questions asked. So when did you grow out of this type of work? Because obviously it's not the type of thing you want to do all your life, is it?
Well, my father was not well. He retired.
Right.
And he bought a milk bar in West Footscray.
Oh, good place to start. Get a milk bar. We're talking about West Footscray.
West Footscray, all the way down towards Tottenham, down Barclay Street.
And you're talking about, what, the 80s? Or late 70s.
Late 70s.
Late 70s, yeah. And people think it's violent now. They think it's violent, yeah. Well, so you moved back into the family home.
He convinced me to manage this milk bar.
All right.
I did a terrible job of that.
All right.
But I stuck it out for a couple of years.
What do you mean you did a terrible job? What, you didn't let people pay?
What,
you felt sorry for people and gave them food without paying?
There was a bit of that.
There was a bit of that, yeah. Well, that's not very good for the profits.
I was shocked when they didn't pay, actually.
Were?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I was.
Well, it wasn't a very nice place to live in. It was tough. I mean, you didn't have $1 million houses or $2 million houses in West Footscray in those days. Be lucky to have running water.
Yeah.
So what did you do after you've failed at being a milk bar manager?
I think I worked for Bricklayers.
Right. What a brickies labourer.
Yeah. I think I did a bit of touring around. So I remember working at Harvey Bay, working for Bricklayer.
Right.
I probably did that for 2 years.
How many bricks would the bricklayer lay a day?
Depends on whether they're doing a straight run or they've got to do a lot of corners or sills.
Right.
But a gun bricklayer could lay 1,000 bricks in a day.
And you just had to keep up that supply?
Yeah, it was actually very hard in Queensland because it's sandy, so it's hard to push the barrow around. And in Queensland, they don't use brick cleaners. So the bricklayer's labourer, as well as keeping up all the mud and bricks and scaffold to the bricklayer, has to brush down the job at the right, oh, well, iron, rake and iron the joints and then brush down the job at the right time and then use a sponge to wash all the brickwork down. You had to do that while you're doing all these other things.
Oh. Is that when you got your nickname?
My nickname?
Yeah, Riggy, whatever it was you said at the beginning.
Riggsy?
Yeah, is that when you got your nickname?
No. That's just what construction workers always call me.
That was later on, I'd say.
That was later on.
You're just Terry. Mm. Yeah, all right. All right, this doesn't sound like much of a life, mate. Itinerant life, going here, going there. Very typical of the period. If you didn't have qualifications or skills, you know, it's typical of that. I remember the good old days here when you stand on a street corner in the early 70s and the truck would come along and say, you, and you to work on a construction site, you know, for a
I've
day.
I've done that. Done that at the at the meatworks.
Oh, right.
You'd have to get there, like, in the dark at about 5 in the morning.
Yep.
And the men would just stand around.
Yeah.
And eventually somebody would come through the gate. They want this many people for this job and that. All right, you'll do.
Yeah, and the rest can go home.
Yeah, see you later. That's what they did in the wharfs too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because, the Meat Workers Union. I mean, a lot of people forget how... Was that your first introduction to unionism with the meat workers?
Yeah, but it wasn't a very good introduction because when I worked at the meat works, that was in the Altona area at Borthwick's.
Yep.
Wally Curran was the organiser.
Yep.
And he's a fire man. And there wasn't a lot of discussion about action. He would just say, he would take some sort of, sometimes there'd be some sort of vote, but it's difficult because for a start, not everybody spoke English.
Yep.
But anyway, he would essentially say, all right, we're going out, brothers.
That was it.
That was it.
If you didn't go out, you're in trouble.
Oh, it's no question. You have to go out.
Did you have the quota system as they had in Queensland? My uncle was a gun boner. He'd go to work at 7 and leave at 11 once he'd done his shift.
Yeah, they called tally. And the tally was in then.
Yeah.
I worked on the pig chain and they had a 500 tally. So the first butcher would go home pretty early, but he started early.
Yeah.
And then you'd finish the line and then the labourers would have to clean up, so probably another hour, an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But we were still going home pretty early.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that would have been negotiated through the union.
It was.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the meat workers were, like, worked a rule, like shearers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They had to. All right, so this sounds fascinating, killing pigs.
I didn't kill any pigs.
You only chopped them up.
I only pushed them around on the rails. That was my job.
What, the meat trolleys?
No, the rails. They're hanging from a rail.
Oh, the rails, right, yeah. God. Do they kind of drip on you? The blood drips on you when you're pushing them around on the rails?
No, they've had a good wash by that time. They've gone
for a sauna. Oh, right. They've been sorted. Yeah, well, all our vegan listeners, you put your hands over your ears now. All right, so you are, how long did you last there?
A couple of years. I worked in more than one meatworks. Worked in on the pig chain. I worked in the skin sheds, hanging skins.
Right.
It's a hard job, actually. Hanging them's not too bad, but the bloke on the ground, he's got to throw the wet skin up onto a plank.
Right.
And then there's two blokes up on that plank and they hang it to dry them out. It was pretty hard. And I worked in the freezers.
Were all these unionised jobs or somewhere?
Oh, yeah, well, at the very least you had to pay your dues.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
There might not have been too much union activity.
But you had to pay your dues. They were closed shops then.
It was a closed shop, definitely.
In those days, you didn't pay your dues, you didn't work. It was that simple.
Yeah.
Right? So when did you see the light and leave the meat industry?
I was working in Queensland and one of my brothers had a job. He was offered a job in Gippsland.
Right.
And he said, I think I'm getting you on here. So, and at the time, it would have been the best job in the country. It was where they were building the oil rig jackets at Barry Beach.
Yep.
And I didn't have any trade skills. But in those days, every tradesman or every pair of tradesmen had a TA. So there's none of this tradesmen working back to back, no TA. So that was just another rule, and it was like strictly enforced. So they had to employ a lot of TAs.
Yep.
So he got a job there. I got a job there and worked there for probably 4 years.
How old were you by then?
I was in my mid-20s.
All right. Romance, marriage, anything yet? No, just shakes his head. It is raining.
Just riding around my motorcycle. Doing
what type of motorcycle did you have?
GS 1000. Then.
Right. Without a helmet?
Oh, hell. No, he always wore a helmet. And anyway, I don't know if you've ever been in South Gippsland. It's bitterly cold.
It is, it is.
You need to put gear on. We didn't have very good riding gear.
No.
It's like I've never been so cold my whole life.
Yeah, all right. Well, it sounds very exciting.
It was exciting because they actually, the wages were pretty good and the conditions were pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I was introduced into collective bargaining.
Right. Could you explain to our listeners what collective bargaining is? They'd have no idea, most of them, except the old ones.
It's just when a workforce negotiates through their representatives in the union for their working conditions and their pay.
Yep.
And at the time,
it is like
I'm just trying to think of particular.
Well, look, I'll keep talking while you think.
I'm trying to think of the organiser's name, but it won't come to me. He finished up being the secretary of the metalworkers.
All right.
Their most famous secretary. Like, I've just had a senior moment here.
Don't worry.
But anyway, we would have regular meetings about issues like superannuation, but RDOs. RDO was a big one.
Yeah.
And they just would not...
Rostered days off, yep.
They would not come at an RDO. So we would have a monthly meeting and the issue would be discussed, resolutions taken, and we would just decide to go home for the day.
Yep, yep.
And we did that every month for quite a few months. So it did put a lot of pressure on management. I don't know if it pressured the government that much, but it definitely swung the dial a bit.
Yep.
And it wasn't that much later that those conditions came in. It was only in the 80s, middle 80s, we got superannuation RDOs. Yeah.
You realise what you're doing is now illegal.
What?
Under the law. You can only take strike action during an enterprise bargaining agreement period. Yeah. I mean, it's all illegal, all that stuff that you used to do, you know. Stop the concrete pools, collective bargaining.
The concrete pools were funny, weren't they?
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's true. And also secondary boycotts. That was a big issue.
That was huge. Yeah.
That was one of Norm Gallagher's biggest strategies. Like, if he was getting nowhere on a job, he'd just say, all right, brothers, we're going to hit him somewhere else.
Yeah,
yeah. You're not allowed to do that now.
No. Can get fined $10,000 a day, each individual worker. That's the law. So you're part of the Metal Workers Union at that stage?
No.
What were you part of?
This country is like, has a funny system for union coverage.
Demarcation, that's what it's about.
If you're working in oil and gas.
Right.
You're in the and you're doing what I was doing. You're in the iron workers,
right?
We're in the iron workers then, which changed their name quite frequently.
Were you thinking of Carmichael,
Laurie Carmichael?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. When he was an organizer, he wasn't the secretary,
right? Yeah,
did a good job too,
right? So you were involved basically. In the discussions, it just wasn't handed down from above.
No, it was definitely a discussion. But yeah, look, there's a lot of men work, almost no women actually. So it was just men.
Yeah.
It could have been 2,000.
2,000, yeah.
So all the unions met. So the majority would be the iron workers, maybe metal workers too. Definitely metal workers, but they wouldn't be the majority, and the electricians, etc.
Right. So how long did you last in that job?
Well, you go. I lasted, was 10 months for the first jacket.
Yep.
We had a short break and came back and did 4 more jackets. So in total, probably 4 or 5 years.
Right.
So it was well, it involved having to travel to South Gippsland.
Yeah.
Not daily, of course. Just renting some accommodation. But accommodation was pretty cheap. Travel was pretty cheap, yeah, so that was all good. And there was a lot of solidarity amongst the brothers in those days. And
why do you think there was that solidarity?
Just from shared adversity. It was like everything was a struggle. Mm. Every condition was a struggle. And they were hard-fought battles. So the ironworkers did not have, for instance, any inclement weather provisions to enable you to go home.
Yep.
You didn't have to work in the rain.
No.
But you had to stay on the job.
In the shed playing cards.
In the sheds, in a 40-foot shed full of smoke.
Yeah.
You could not see the other end of the shed.
That's right.
The brothers would play 500.
Yeah.
There'd be...
Fire in the corner?
No fire in the corner.
Right.
But Gippsland can be just very inhospitable. We spent 5 consecutive days in the sheds 1 year.
Mm.
So that's 11-hour days. Four 11s and an 8.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of cabin fever.
So is this when you finished here? Is this when you moved into construction?
Yes.
So where did you start off in construction?
Oh, well, I started off there. So brother suggested we upskill. So we used to ride to sail to the technical college to do the rigging course.
Perfect for your names.
It's a bit of a coincidence, isn't it?
The rigs are doing the rigging course.
Also scaffolding. Rigging and scaffolding.
What's the difference?
Oh, there's a big difference, Joe.
Like, well, that's why I asked. I don't know.
Scaffolding is just building working platforms for usually tradesmen and other activities.
Yeah.
Rigging's pretty varied, really. So that could go anywhere from directing the crane to selecting the lifting gear to moving machinery, erecting cranes.
And what did you learn all this down at Sail Tech College?
We did.
Oh, so it must have been a good course.
It was a good course.
And you got a certificate out of it.
I didn't get a certificate out of it. Well, that's right, it was a certificate in those days, and now it's a licence.
That's right, yeah. All right, and what, that gave you the ability to work in the construction industry?
It gave me the opportunity to work as a scaffolder and a rigger in the construction industry.
What, down at Sail or back in Melbourne?
No, back in Melbourne. I did, when I finished that job, I bought a motorcycle and went touring, and... So I went to North Queensland and Western Australia. So I worked in timber mills, worked for bricklayers. And my brother's come to my rescue again.
All right.
And he said...
is your younger brother, rescuing his older brother.
My younger brother.
Yeah, typical.
He said, listen, there's a building boom going on in Melbourne. Just get over here. I'll get you a job.
Was this during the Kane era or pre-Kane?
86.
And the BLF been deregistered yet?
They got deregistered that year.
It was all your fault, wasn't it? So what, you joined and then you got deregistered. Right. It's all your fault, Riggsy, as they say.
Yeah.
All right, so you came to the big city and...
It was good. Like it's one thing to have a certificate, it's another thing to know how to do the job.
Yeah.
So I spent a number of years at the pointy end to develop some skills. But we've got a good range of work. There's no shortage of work, like plenty of overtime.
Yeah.
So they were just desperate for scaffold.
Well, if you're building, I remember John Kane Jr., he'd look out his office window and he'd say, oh, things are going really well. Look at all the cranes out there.
So many cranes, so many tower cranes on the horizon.
Yeah. Were you involved in any disputes that year in 86 when the BLF was deregistered?
A number of rallies.
Mm-hmm.
When we were deregistered, we were told if they threaten you with the sack, you'll just have to sign over to the BWIU.
Right.
So that's what happened.
The Building Works Industrial, yeah. And that's it?
That was it, yeah. Nothing much changed. Most of us still paid our BLF dues.
Right.
And still went to the branch meetings.
Well, they still needed you, didn't they? They worked out they couldn't make the building without you people, you blokes, you know.
It's funny, though.
It's funny that, isn't it? Yeah.
They can't do it working from home, you know.
No, that's right. Rigging scaffolding from home. I could see it now. You can do this course, you know, on Zoom. Oh, you'll love it. This could be a new career for you. Zoom rigging, Zoom scaffolding. Teach people how to do it. Yeah.
Because it's hard work.
It is.
It's like scaffolding is a bit of an art, and takes a long time to have enough skills to say that you're competent. But most of that job is carrying gear.
Yeah.
So 90% of the job's carrying gear.
Well, the fact is, it's fundamental safety in the workplace to have a good scaffold. If you don't. Accidents. Did you see many accidents when you were in construction?
Very, very few in relation to scaffold.
Right.
There was one death that was at the Shell Geelong when they put a new cracker into the refinery there.
Right.
I've been very, very fortunate. It's only by chance because... still about the same number of people die every year. It's about 500.
Yeah.
500 die in the workplace most years, and that number hasn't changed for like 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, although the population has almost tripled, so it hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. Well, the Occupational Health and Safety Act really was a game changer.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that? Because most people have forgotten what it was.
Well, it's still...
It's still there, but they've forgotten why it's there.
They changed it a bit. Essentially, that was something that was generated from the disaster of the West Gate Bridge.
Yep.
So 15 men died there.
Yep.
And there were concerns brought up on that job, ignored by the employers.
That's right.
Victorian Occupational Health and Safety Act was essentially mirrored by a UK health and safety report called the Robins Report. And so most of those principles were adopted. So they finished up with an act and they finished up with regulations.
Right.
So one of the biggest ramifications were that employees had the right to have a representative that they were able to consult with in relation to their occupational health and safety. So you had a health and safety rep. And the big group, the building industry group, ran a 5-day course which was cited in the regulations. And you could do an update every year. So they gave people formal training in occupational health and safety.
As you said, consequence of the Westgate Bridge disaster and the ensuing Royal Commission.
Yes.
So have you been involved in any particular unions outside being a member, a delegate, organiser?
I've been a health and safety rep and a shop steward.
For which union?
For the CFMEU.
Right. What, the construction division?
Yes.
Right. How long have you been were you doing that for?
Well, I was a health and safety rep when the Act was very new. The first occasion was the plumbers' building in Cardigan Street. And the second occasion was the Shell Refinery, Geelong. When that man died, there was no structure there for occupational health and safety. They didn't have a health and safety committee. They didn't have any health and safety reps. There are a number of contractors on there, so it's not as if it's just one employer.
Yeah.
So we sat in the sheds for a week till they actually got that structure together. So just at a meeting, was decided that we should have a occupational health and safety committee, and we needed health and safety reps, and they called for nominations, and I found myself putting my hand up.
Right. Well, you were so incensed by it all.
Well, yeah. It was like I was only about 50 metres from where that man died.
And yeah.
We didn't even stop work because nobody told us. We were up in a boom lift, like bolting steel together.
Right. And nobody said anything.
Nobody said anything.
So how many years were you in that role of a health and safety officer?
Well, that was about a year and a half for that one.
Yeah. Did you have trouble gaining access to work sites?
I'm on the work site. I'm working there as a rig of scaffolding.
So you're actually working on the work site, you know?
There's no issue there at all. But I have never been an organiser, and they do have trouble accessing the sites because, well, first of all, employers don't want them there. The second is that's a major hazard facility. There's legislation about who can come and go, what sort of security you have. So they can make it very difficult for organisers to gain access.
Right.
And they used to do that.
All the time, yeah. All right, so... And you said you were an organiser at one stage?
No, I was a shop steward.
Shop steward. So what's the difference between an organiser and a shop steward?
Well,
a
shop steward's on the job.
Yep.
He doesn't go to other jobs.
Right.
Organiser might have to look after usually an area.
Mm-hmm.
He could have 100 jobs he'd have to go to.
Right.
So the shop steward is a workers' representative in industrial matters. And these days it's very common for the shop steward to also be the health and safety representative because even though that's not my preference, I always thought they should be separate. But there are definitely advantages for the one person having both roles, and that's very common now.
Right. So what are you, a past member of the CFMEU or continue to hold a
I'm
ticket?
I'm a retired member.
You're a retired member, past member, retired member.
Yeah.
When did you become a retired member?
December last year.
Right. So what do you reckon about all this kerfuffle that's going on?
Well, I've been in the industry for a long time.
How many years do you think?
Well, over 50.
Right.
But not all in commercial construction.
No.
I've worked more in oil and gas. So I've worked more fly in, fly out.
Right.
Or shutdown work.
Right.
It's a big ship and it takes a lot of organisation, takes a lot of hard work. There's a lot of people. Some of them are going to be bad eggs.
Yeah.
Some of them are going to have motivation that is not altruistic.
Yeah.
And that would be the same in Victoria Police
yeah.
as it would be in the
Anywhere
CFA.
Else. Yeah.
Houses of Parliament.
Well, it's interesting, you know, the lack of charges and all the kerfuffle, you know. It's just amazing.
Where's all the convictions?
Yeah, yeah. Even the charges, not even convictions, but charges. It's extraordinary.
The same for the commissions that they've had in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't ever remember, like, people going to jail.
No, no.
But there was, and I don't think they looked very closely at the employer side either.
No, I reckon it's, it'd be interesting. I assume a lot of employers are shitting themselves at the minute with this Royal Commission. Remember the last time they had a big Royal Commission with the painters and dockers?
Mm.
They came out relatively unscathed, while the people who were providing the finance and running the businesses came under a huge amount of pressure because of their corrupt activities. It takes two to tango.
There's a lot more corruption on the other side, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what the... it'll be interesting to see the terms of reference, because...
It's just going to be a wait. The new premiers decide they're going to have a Royal Commission.
Yeah.
That's going to cost the taxpayer many, many millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And it's just going to mirror, like, past...
Yeah.
Endeavours, like, if you dig deep enough, you will find some dirt.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were some questionable decisions made by senior CFMEU, but, you know, I remember Norm Gallagher being interviewed one time, and the reporter said, "You've made some bad decisions, Mr. Gallagher." And he... Norm says, "That's true."
Yeah.
He said, "But I've made a lot of decisions."
Yeah. Well, that's right. You do, mate. All right. It's interesting, you know, you're in the business of the CFMEU, because it is, I assume the Premier had to call a Royal Commission in order to clear the air, in inverted commas, to save their political necks, because the way that everybody was ganging out. But you never hear anything about the employers. Never, not a word.
Politics is a dirty business, and like, I was really disappointed in the ACTU and the Labor Party.
Yeah.
At the first whiff of a questionable television program.
Yep.
Exposing corruption, they both threw us under a bus.
Yeah, yeah. Alleged corruption.
That's right. Where's the charges? Where's the convictions, you know?
I reckon you people, Teflon-coated, the CFMEU is as Teflon-coated as the financial sector. Remember the great collapse in 2008? The banking Royal Commission and all the horrible things they get? How many people do you think were charged?
I don't know.
None. It's
The CFMEU has fought the good fight, though, they have paid many, many millions of dollars in fines just for trying to negotiate for the membership in good faith, even though it might have been illegal.
Yeah,
and actually, at one point in the 80s, they very nearly lost their building because they took on a blue with Troubleshooters, who are a Labor hire company, but you're not going to win that blue in the courts.
No.
And that's what happened. They lost millions. And they couldn't afford millions then. They weren't nearly as financial.
Yeah.
And they should have just fought that with guerrilla tactics the way Norm would have done it.
Yeah.
And they would have won it.
Yeah, well, the difference today is, as I said at the beginning, is... it's illegal to strike in this country outside an enterprise bargaining agreement period. If you're involved in a wildcat, which basically means sitting in the shed and refusing to work, an individual worker can be fined $10,000 a day, and people in West Australia were fined about 10 years ago.
On that rail project.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's right.
That's right.
And fortunately, there was a national campaign there.
Yeah.
So those individuals didn't pay that money.
No.
As far as I know.
No.
I think it was like a GoFundMe thing.
That's right. I think people forget what it was like, as you said, in the early days in the construction industry, before the BLF actually got
The labourers had terrible conditions. Yeah. Like, I'm old enough to have worked on a job where There are no facilities whatsoever.
No.
And there is a shed for you.
Yeah.
But it's a cement shed. Yeah. That's to keep the cement dry.
Right,
and it's about the size of a toilet.
That's right.
That's where you go if it rains.
Yeah, and you can breathe in the dust, the cement dust. I mean, I remember it was like the 1970 or 71 I came to Melbourne, right? I won't tell you why. But here at the corner of Smith Street and Victoria Parade, you would stand on the corner, a truck would come around. There's all these blokes, as you said, milling around, and he'd say, you, 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 and you. You'd jump on the back of a truck. You'd work on a construction site.
Yeah.
You'd have no safety equipment. There was nothing, you know. And at the end of the day, you got a cash payment.
Yes.
And you were thankful for it, basically. And that's what it was like.
But one thing they had in those days were... you might not have had an Occupational Health and Safety Act, and you might not have even had a very good EBA.
Yeah.
But most of the workers had solidarity, and as far as their, at least their occupational health and safety, there was a way of doing things, and that will not be deviated from. It's not written down.
Right, yeah.
It's just the custom and practice of your work, and this is what, how we do it. And employers could not shake that.
Yeah. Do you think today, because of improved wages and conditions, that solidarity is broken down?
It's pretty halfway down the toilet,
Jim. Half down the toilet. Explain. Please explain, Terry.
Well, the industry is characterised by boom and bust, and which is like, not a lot of fun. Like,
no.
You got so much work at one time, like you've got to work Sundays.
Yep.
And then there'll be nothing. You actually have to leave the industry and go and, I don't know, mix mud for bricklayers or
yep.
go and work in a supermarket or something.
Yeah.
But the industry has been very stable for the last 20 years, and they've really made some pretty good gains on wages and conditions. The brothers have had it too good, and so there's not much of shared adversity going on there. When things were tough and people really had to fight for conditions, there was solidarity. And if you betrayed your brothers, there's a consequence of that.
Mm.
And, like, people would shun you.
Yeah.
For the rest of your life.
I remember I did some research on the maritime strike on the wharves here in 1928, and people were actually being killed,
yeah.
chucked over bridges
yeah.
because they were scabs.
Yes.
That's what it was like. Yeah, they were shunned. You couldn't walk down Port Melbourne without...
Well, one of the older scaffolders I work with... he was telling stories about the Newport power stations like 20 years after the event
yeah.
and talking about various individuals that crossed the picket line.
Never to be spoken to again.
Never to be spoken to again.
Never invited to a CMFEU barbecue again. Now, during these years, did you kind of have a family or anything?
Yeah, I did. I met a while I was touring on my bike in Western Australia.
Oh, as you do. Yeah.
I met a young woman. She was a forester.
All right.
And one thing led to another. We got a 6 week old baby, and that's when we moved to Melbourne to work as a scaffolder.
Yeah. How many children you got?
Just one.
Just one. What do you think about his future? He'd be an old man now, wouldn't he?
He's 40?
Yeah.
Well, his mother left me after when he was about, probably about four.
Yeah.
So, but she did a really good job bringing him up.
Him up, yeah.
And he has been, he started off, he did a double degree at the RMIT, electrical engineering,
mm-hmm.
and computer programming. So he works in the IT industry. He's got a job in London, and he's been quite successful.
So do you think the brothers are going to throw their support behind One Nation?
There's a lot of conservative people.
I know. I'm amazed.
I'm amazed too.
Yeah. As you said, when people get comfortable, good, excellent wage for the work they do, good conditions. You're not the only person in the CFMEU I know personally and spoken to and chatted to, and there are a lot of...
One of the things that struck me was that, I wasn't doing very well probably about 6 years ago. I was sort of not very well, hadn't worked for a while. Mm. I'd been divorced.
Yeah.
And I was just living on a 5-acre bush block with not much on it.
Right.
And but I did have contacts in the union, which I didn't really access. But socially, I would still meet some of them,
right,
like Craig Johnson,
yeah,
and Brenda Murphy.
Mm.
Craig Johnson got me a job as a Peggy.
Oh, right.
So your listeners probably won't know what a Peggy is.
Mm. What, do you peg out? No, peg out
you
distances?
You don't know what a Peggy is.
Peg out distances? No.
No.
What is a Peggy?
Peggy's just the fellow who cleans the smoker shed.
Oh, right. Why are you
cleans
called
the
a
toilets.
Peggy? Why are you called a Peggy?
Actually, I do know what it is. It comes from old England.
Right.
And the masons used pegs, usually as spacers, I think,
right,
in their work.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of the job, they'd be redundant.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, desperate people, will come along and pick those pegs up. I don't know what they use them for. Anyway, somehow or other, that is the genesis of the name.
Yeah, I've got a different genesis.
All right.
You'd have to put a peg on your nose when you clean the toilet, knowing some of those toilets.
They can be bad.
Yes, and maybe that's where it came from, Peggy. Yeah. All right.
There's worse things in life, though.
Yeah.
I quite liked it, and that really saved me because I had had no super that went into... I had a farm at the time before I was divorced.
Yeah.
But no super, no savings.
No.
And all I had was a car and that bush block. Craig went to Robbie Gorman, the former president of the CFMEU. I knew Robbie as an organiser when I was the shop steward.
Yep.
And he said, yeah, I think we can get you a job.
Oh, that's good. Now, I've noticed you around 3CR. We've got about a minute. Why? What have you been doing at 3CR?
Well, I've been in Melbourne for a while.
Yeah.
And I know it's a volunteer organisation.
Yeah.
I'm a long-time listener.
Uh-huh.
And I came around and saw Inez, and Inez says, well, we might be able to find a spot for you.
Good.
And occasionally I would be the fill-in receptionist.
Well, welcome to 3CR. Hopefully it'll be a long, positive relationship. Don't listen to everything you hear about 3CR. It's a wonderful organisation.
I've never heard anything bad said about 3CR.
I have. We move in different circles. Obviously. What's right? We've got the concrete gang here. They've been here for 50 years. Are you going to go to the August birthday party?
I'm very hopeful, but I do have something else on that day.
Oh, right.
I might be able to swing it.
Yeah.
I went to the retired members too.
Right, right.
That was very good. They did a great job of that.
Yeah, that's excellent. Well, Riggsy, Terry Riggs, thank you for coming in and sharing bits and pieces of your life.
Thanks very much, Joe.
No, it was a pleasure talking to you. And thank you, Henrietta. And Henrietta is going to make you a star. She's taking your photograph. She's going to do a podcast. She's going to listen to it. She's going to put a few comments on it. She's just an extraordinary human being. See, there are two types of people at 3CR. You need to remember, Terry. There are show ponies who do nothing but talk. That's
movers
me.
Movers and shakers.
And and the draft horses who do all the work.
Yeah.
There's no movers and shakers. All right. Oh, we got a minute to go. So what are you going to do for the rest of your life? What, did you sell a bush block, or are you going to develop it, or are you going to build a house on
I'm
it?
I'm going to live there.
Yeah? Have you built a house on it, a shed?
I'm going to build some sort of residence. Right now it's got a railway carriage on it.
Oh,
that's
right.
That's my accommodation.
That railway carriage. Isn't it cold?
It's got a heater in there.
How far up north is it? Or is it Gippsland or?
No, Western Victoria.
Western Victoria.
About 3 hours from Melbourne.
Well, I'll have to come and knock on your door one day.
You can do that.
Yeah. And what, you're still motorbiking?
I've had a recurrent injury which has stopped me from riding, but I've had some recent surgery and I think I'll be good to go.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Riggsy, if I may call you that, for coming into the studio. Thank you, Henrietta, and thank
you. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.